From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Not with the previous Democratic leader or the current Democratic leader have ever I been slapped in the face with such an affront to the leadership of this grand institution.
His investigation has been stymied, stopped, obstructions thrown up every step of the way. That's the real slap in the face. That's the slap in the face. And today the American people are going to see a little bit of light.
Democrats enrage the Republican leadership by forcing a closed Senate session to question pre-war intelligence. But first, a cry for help from Guantanamo. A detainee attempts suicide in front of his lawyer.
I looked towards the area of the cell, however, and saw Juma hanging by his neck from the top of a mesh metal wall that encloses the cell. He also had what appeared to be a very serious gash on the inside of his right arm, which was causing him to bleed on himself and also on the floor.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill Tuesday, Democrats forced the Republican-controlled Senate into closed session to question intelligence used by the Bush administration to justify the Iraq invasion. In the rare move, public spectators were cleared out. The doors were closed, lights dimmed in the Senate chamber. The intelligence behind the U.S. invasion of Iraq remains a key issue with last week's indictment of Vice President Cheney Chief of Staff Louis Libby over the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Shortly before forcing the closed session, Democratic Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said, quote, "The Libby indictment provides a window into what this is really all about, how this administration manufactured and manipulated intelligence in order to sell the war in Iraq and attempted to destroy those who dared to challenge its actions." Republican leaders dismissed the closed session as a political stunt. However, they agreed to a bipartisan review of a Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into pre-war intelligence. Democrats have called the investigation inadequate. The Washington Post is reporting the CIA has been hiding and interrogating important al-Qaeda detainees at a Soviet-era secret prison in Eastern Europe. The prison's part of a small global network of secret CIA and military compounds used in the so-called War on Terror, including the Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba. At the request of U.S. officials, the Washington Post did not publish the names of the Eastern European countries involved in the secret program. Intelligence officials and legal experts told the Post the prisons would, quote, be considered illegal under the laws of several host countries where detainees have rights to have a lawyer or to mount a defense against allegations of wrongdoing. Meanwhile, the New York Times reporting the Bush administration is engaged in an internal debate over new guidelines for interrogating detainees. Vice President Cheney's new chief of staff, David Addington, has emerged as a key opponent of including language from the Geneva Conventions that prohibits inhumane treatment. Addington was promoted from chief counsel following last week's resignation and indictment of Louis Libby. The Times reports Addington verbally assailed an aide who referenced Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions in a Pentagon briefing. Speaking of the aide, a Pentagon official told the Times, quote, "He left bruised and bloody. He tried to champion Article 3, and Addington just ate him for lunch." The NAACP has voiced strong concerns over Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. At a fundraising event Tuesday, NAACP President Bruce Gordon said, quote, "I sense this is a nomination that may not be consistent with the America that Rosa Parks sat down to create. If I see the extreme right celebrating this nomination, that puts my antenna up," he said. The judge presiding over campaign finance charges against Republican congressional leader Tom DeLay was removed from the case Tuesday. DeLay's lawyers had argued for the dismissal of Texas District Judge Bob Perkins because of donations he's made to Democratic candidates and to the liberal advocacy group Move On. DeLay is also seeking to have the trial moved out of Austin, saying the state capitol is one of the last enclaves of the Democratic Party in Texas. Also Tuesday, President Bush unveiled a $7.1 billion plan for combating the possible outbreak of a global flu pandemic. This is Bush speaking yesterday to a gathering of scientists and health officials at the National Institutes of Health.
Our strategy is designed to meet three critical goals. First, we must detect outbreaks that occur anywhere in the world. Second, we must protect the American people by stockpiling vaccines and antiviral drugs and improve our ability to rapidly produce new vaccines against a pandemic strain. And third, we must be ready to respond at the federal, state, and local levels in the event that a pandemic reaches our shores.
Most of the proposed funding will go to buying vaccines and developing new ones. The Washington Post notes Bush's plan would leave states responsible for covering up to 75% of the cost of the vaccines. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times observes Bush's plan would leave the Department of Homeland Security, not Health and Human Services, in charge of the federal response to a flu pandemic. Kim Elliott, deputy director of the nonprofit Nonpartisan Trust for America's Health, told the Times, quote, "When the emergency occurs, it would be handed to folks, most of whom have not been trained on the public health aspects." Meanwhile, Fortune magazine is reporting Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld stands to reap a financial windfall from the sale of flu vaccines. Rumsfeld is an investor in Gilead Sciences, the California company that owns the patent to Tamiflu, the influenza remedy currently the most sought-after drug in the world. Rumsfeld was Gilead's chair from 1997 until joining the Bush administration in 2001. His stake in the company is valued at between $5 million and $25 million. This news from Ethiopia. Government officials say at least 8 people were killed and 43 wounded in clashes between police and protesters in the capital city of Addis Ababa Tuesday. The country is embroiled in a bitter dispute surrounding May parliamentary elections. The opposition party, Coalition for Unity and Democracy, claims it won the elections over the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front. The protests were called in the lead-up to a general strike set for later this month. Government officials said several top CUD leaders have been arrested and warned journalists of detention if they publish what they call baseless reports and propaganda from the opposition. In other world news, a prison riot in the Central Asian state of Kyrgyzstan has claimed the lives of a reported 20 prisoners. A prison official denied the toll, saying only 5 had been killed. Officials said the riots erupted after an attempt to transfer a powerful gang leader to a different prison, but officials also conceded the prisoners had been waging hunger strikes in protest of poor conditions. Kyrgyzstan is a key U.S. ally in the region, hosting a U.S. military base often used for flights to neighboring Afghanistan. The Palestinian group Hamas is warning Israel has started a war by waging targeted killings of its leadership. 2 Palestinian militant leaders were killed in an Israeli strike on a vehicle they were traveling in Tuesday. Agence France-Presse is reporting at least 10 Palestinian civilian bystanders were wounded in the attack, which took place near the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. A senior Hamas official said, quote, "Israel has started a war with this assassination and it will pay a heavy price." Hamas has claimed responsibility for the killing of an Israeli soldier today in Jenin. The New York Times is reporting new evidence has emerged about the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964 that precipitated the escalation of the Vietnam War. A National Security Agency historian has determined officers at the agency knowingly falsified intelligence in order to make it look as if North Vietnam had attacked U.S. destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf. Following the alleged attack, Johnson ordered retaliatory airstrikes on North Vietnamese targets and used the event to persuade Congress to pass the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which led to the escalation of the war. The NSA's historian determined the intelligence may have been falsified not for political reasons, but to cover up earlier mistakes made by intelligence officers. However, the Times reports there's also been a cover-up of the historian's account, which was first published in a classified in-house journal of the National Security Agency in 2001. The historian's article remains classified. According to the Times, policymakers at the NSA feared the release of the historical study might prompt uncomfortable comparisons with the flawed intelligence used to justify the war in Iraq. World can't wait. Over 200 protests and rallies are scheduled today across the country as part of a national day of action organized by the group The World Can't Wait, Drive Out the Bush Regime. In New York, the protests began Tuesday after one of the city's leading hip-hop stations, Hot 97, rejected a paid ad promoting the protests. This is a part of that ad.
Hey, this is Boots Riley from the Coup. The world can't wait to drive out the Bush regime. November 2nd, no work, no school. We're going to march. Join us. 12 noon at Union Square. Come on, you've seen the pictures. Bush made torture into a sport and justifies it. You saw Iraq destroyed by a war based on lies. We all watched Bush leave people to die in New Orleans and treat people like criminals. This regime is what's criminal.
Organizers with World Can't Wait are urging students across the country to walk out of classes in support of the protest. In Seattle, the Post Intelligencer reports student walkouts are scheduled in over two dozen schools. And in Detroit, thousands of people are preparing to honor Rosa Parks at her funeral today. Over the past day, tens of thousands visited the Charles Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit to pay their respects. The civil rights pioneer died last week at the age of 92. The Reverend Jesse Jackson is to give the eulogy. Aretha Franklin will sing. Yesterday, Reverend Jackson called Rosa Parks, quote, the mother of a new America. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to our ongoing coverage examining the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay. The Bush administration has decided not to allow human rights investigators from the United Nations to meet with any detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. For 3 years, UN investigators have been trying to visit the prison camp. A breakthrough appeared to have occurred last week when the Pentagon invited three UN experts to visit Guantanamo, but the invitation was on the condition they had no access to the detainees. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Manfred Nowak, said it now makes no sense to send UN experts to Guantanamo under these conditions. He said, quote, they said they have nothing to hide. If they have nothing to hide, why should we not be able to talk to detainees in private? Until now, the prisoners have been largely held incommunicado from the outside world, with the exception of occasional visits by attorneys. We now turn to one of these attorneys, Joshua Colangelo Bryan. He represents six men from Bahrain who've been held without charge at Guantanamo. 2 weeks ago, he witnessed one of his clients, Juma Dossery, trying to commit suicide. More than 20 other detainees have also tried to commit suicide, but according to the Washington Post, this is believed to be the first such event witnessed by an outsider at the prison. Lawyers and human rights advocates say this highlights the growing desperation among the more than 500 prisoners there. We reached Joshua Colangelo Bryan Tuesday in Ecuador. I asked him to explain who his clients are and what he saw when he visited them.
My law firm has represented six citizens of Bahrain who have been detained at Guantanamo for the past several years. We initiated our representation in the summer of 2004 and since then have been down to Guantanamo a number of times to meet with our clients. In October of this year, I was at Guantanamo visiting with each of our six clients, including Juma Al-Dosari. Juma is a 32-year-old divorced father of a 10-year-old daughter. He is generally a very affable person, very personable. We have quite informal conversations about a range of subjects and certainly have developed a certain understanding and closeness over the course of my visits. On October 15th, in the afternoon, I was meeting with him when he needed to use the bathroom. And without describing in elaborate detail the procedures at Guantanamo, that requires my calling MPs to come and move him from our meeting area to a small adjacent cell where there's a toilet. The MPs arrived. I left the room. Several minutes later, the MPs came out after having moved Juma into the cell. After a few moments, I decided that I should check and see whether he was finished so that I could come in and speak with him again. I opened the door to the room that houses both the meeting area and the cell. the first thing I saw was a pool of blood on the floor. And strangely, in that first moment, my initial thought was that he had made himself vomit blood, because this is a symptom that he has complained about. And I had the strange thought that maybe he was trying to convince me that it was a genuine symptom and not something that he had made up. A second later, I looked towards the area of the cell, however, and saw Juma hanging by his neck from the top of a mesh metal wall that encloses the cell. He also had what appeared to be a very serious gash on the inside of his right arm, which was causing him to bleed on himself and also on the floor. I immediately yelled for MPs, who arrived quickly. I called Juma's name several times, but he did not respond, and as best I could tell, appeared to be unconscious. The MPs arrived, cut him down from the noose that was holding him, and put him on the floor. Still didn't seem that he was conscious, and I also didn't see him breathing at all. Within a moment or so, I was asked to leave the room, or ordered to leave the room might be more accurate. And as I did, I saw Juma seeming to gasp, which at least struck me as a good sign. I have been told that he was taken for surgery on his arm, and that the surgery was successful, and that he was recovering from it. I was not allowed to see him again during that visit, and all of my requests for information about Juma's condition over the past week and a half have been completely ignored. So at the moment, I don't have any idea of how he is and what his condition is. My requests to return to Guantanamo for a visit next week have not been approved either. So at this point, the military is not providing me with any information about his health and is not permitting me to go see him. For that reason, I will be going to the court shortly to ask for that and also related relief, relief that we hope will ease the conditions that we believe clearly have led him to be in a suicidal state.
Did you have any indication before that your client, that Juma, would try to commit suicide?
Juma has tried to commit suicide several times while in Guantanamo. One of his suicide attempts, in fact, was described in a book by Eric Saar, who I know has appeared on your program, and who was a former military intelligence soldier at Guantanamo. In his book, Saar described being called to the scene of a suicide attempt, where he was asked to read writing in blood on the wall of a shower where the suicide attempt occurred. And that writing said, "I committed suicide because of the brutality of my oppressors." That was my client, Juma. He, in fact, described that incident to me about 6 months before the book came out. So it was certainly quite chilling to read the book describing the same event. There have been other suicide attempts as well. The problem is that the military's response to those suicide attempts has been to keep Juma in virtual isolation for nearly 2 years. At this point, he is held in a cell from which he can see no other human beings. He's held in a cell from which he can occasionally communicate with another detainee by shouting, but frequently cannot. He is permitted approximately an hour of exercise a week. And he is, at this point, not even permitted to have books other than the Quran. So based on my understanding of his conditions, there's really no surprise that he has attempted to commit suicide again. That having been said, there was no indication during my meeting with him that a suicide attempt would be forthcoming immediately. In fact, as I was leaving the room to allow him to be moved into the cell, we shared a quick joke. So I certainly had no inkling that something like that was about to occur. But it's not surprising in light of how he's been treated for the past 2 years in particular.
What is Juma charged with?
Juma, like all 750 detainees or so who have passed through Guantanamo, with the exception of four, is not charged with anything. He notably is not even accused of having been involved in any violence. What the government says is that he was, quote, present at Tora Bora, close quote. The government does not say when he was at Tora Bora. It does not say what he was doing, if anything, at Tora Bora. It doesn't say with whom, if anyone, he was at Tora Bora. So we are left utterly guessing as to what the true nature of the allegations against him are. I have to note that we have other clients in very similar circumstances against whom, in fact, there are allegations that I would describe as even more minimal.
Can you talk about the other detainees who have made suicide attempts? Are there others that you know of? What is being done about them?
The military has issued periodic reports about suicide attempts, although at times it has chosen to refer to those attempts as self-injurious manipulative behavior or something to that effect. I don't have any personal knowledge about those other attempts. I would certainly have some question about the military's figures, given that there's no independent means to verify them.
What about the hunger strike? Has he been a part of that? And do you know how many prisoners are a part of that?
Juma took part in several hunger strikes that occurred in years past, and also a hunger strike that occurred in June and July of this year. Again, the only numbers we have for overall numbers of detainees participating in the hunger strike come from the military, and we have no means to verify them independently. I do see a commonality between those engaging in hunger strikes and those attempting to commit suicide. We have men who have been held for 4 years without charge, often not even accused of violence. They've been subjected to a range of abuses corroborated by U.S. personnel. They've been prevented from speaking with their families, and they've been told in many instances that they will be in Guantanamo for the rest of their lives. As I see it, these men are exercising what they believe is the only form of control over their own lives that they're able to. So while it was certainly a shocking sight for me to witness, I can't say that it's particularly surprising when you consider Guantanamo as a whole.
I wanted to ask you to respond quickly to Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Martin, spokesperson for the Joint Task Force Guantanamo, who said claims hunger strikers are near death is absolutely false. He said that the protests that began on August 8th at one point had over 130 participants is now much smaller. He said, quote, this technique, hunger striking, is consistent with the Al-Qaeda training and reflects the detainees' attempt to elicit media attention and bring pressure on the United States government.
The military has said that it treats all detainees humanely, yet military personnel at Guantanamo have reported their own firsthand observations very much to the contrary. The U.S. government position is that the men at Guantanamo are the worst of the worst, yet they've released nearly 250 of them. In light of those obviously inaccurate statements, I take anything that the military says with a grain of salt. I have one client who, when I visited him in October, had a feeding tube inserted in his nose, and I would estimate has lost 40 to 50 pounds since the time that I had seen him previously. Whether or not you want to characterize that as being perilously close to death, is certainly up to the individual making the characterization, but there's no disputing the fact that his health has suffered tremendously. And that there's it's the direct result of his engaging in the hunger strike.
I know you have to go, but I just wanted to ask you about the three UN human rights experts who've rejected an invitation to tour Guantanamo until the U.S. government backs down from its refusal to let them meet with detainees in private. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Manfred Nowak, said, right, quote, they said they have nothing to hide. If they have nothing to hide, why should we not be able to talk to the detainees in private? How significant is this? Why is it so important that they speak to them privately?
I met with those individuals last week and was convinced of their sincerity in wanting to find out what's happening in Guantanamo. Certainly a prepackaged publicity tour where people are led around to various facilities and shown sample meals but never get to speak with detainees is, in my mind, an exercise without any value if you're trying to figure out what exactly is happening at Guantanamo. In order to do that, you need to go to the source, and by that I mean the people who are being held there and also the U.S. personnel, military, FBI agents who have worked at Guantanamo and who have reported themselves horrific abuse.
In your experience now, as we wrap up, having been through what you have with your client, what are your thoughts, and have you experienced anything like this in your practice and your career as a lawyer?
I have done post-conflict humanitarian aid work. I have worked on war crimes trials, but I have certainly never seen anything like I did when I walked into that cell on October 15th. To me, it underscores the truly desperate nature of the situation at Guantanamo, the desperate need for the rule of law, and the fact that I believe that the people being held at Guantanamo may well repeat this sort of act in the future if things are not changed, and changed quite drastically.
Joshua Colangelo Ryan is the attorney for detainees at Guantanamo. We reached him in Ecuador. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as on PBS and public access TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks. We're broadcasting on DirecTV Channel 375 and on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and we are podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Democrats forced the Republican-controlled Senate into an unusual closed session Tuesday to question intelligence used by the Bush administration to justify the Iraq invasion. The issue of pre-war intelligence remains in the spotlight with last week's indictment of Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Libby, over the CIA leak case. Shortly before forcing the closed session, Democratic Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said, quote, "The Libby indictment provides a window into what this is really all about, how this administration manufactured and manipulated intelligence in order to sell the war in Iraq and attempted to destroy those who dared to challenge its actions." Reid then invoked a little-used Rule 21 to request the closed session.
Mr. President, enough time has gone by I demand on behalf of the American people that we understand why these investigations aren't being conducted. And in accordance with Rule 21, I now move the Senate go into closed session.
Mr. President, I second the motion.
The Senate stopped work on legislation. The public was forced to leave the chamber. The doors were closed. The lights dimmed. C-SPAN coverage was also turned off for the session, which lasted over 2 hours. The move marked the first time in 25 years one party has closed the Senate to the public without consulting the other party. Republicans dismissed the move as a political stunt. It provoked a sharp public confrontation between the leadership of both parties. This is Senate Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist speaking to reporters.
Democrats use scare tactics. They have no conviction, they have no principles, they have no ideas. But this is the ultimate. Since I've been Majority Leader, I'll have to say, not with the previous Democratic leader or the current Democratic leader have ever I been slapped in the face with such an affront to the leadership of this grand institution.
Frist went on to say, quote, for the next year and a half, I can't trust Senator Reid. Reid later responded to Frist's comments.
It's a slap in the face to the American people that this has been This investigation has been stymied, stopped, obstructions thrown up every step of the way. That's the real slap in the face. That's the slap in the face. And today the American people are going to see a little bit of light.
In the end, lawmakers agreed to name three members from each party to assess the state of the Intelligence Committee's inquiry into pre-war intelligence and report back by November 14th. Back in June 2003, when it became increasingly apparent that no weapons of mass destruction were being found in Iraq, Republicans on the Intelligence Committee initially resisted calls to investigate the administration's WMD claims. Finally, in February 2004, they agreed to a two-step investigation. In July 2004, the committee issued the first phase of its bipartisan report, which found the U.S. intelligence community had assembled a deeply flawed and exaggerated assessment of Saddam Hussein's weapons capabilities. The second phase was to focus on the administration's deliberations over the intelligence or how it was used. Democrats say there's been little examination of these topics to date. We're joined now in our Washington studio by Robert Perry. He's a veteran investigative journalist for years, worked for both the Associated Press and Newsweek magazine. His reporting led to the exposure of what's now called the Iran-Contra scandal. He's author of the book Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Scott Armstrong also joins us in Washington, executive director of the Information Trust. He's a former reporter for the Washington Post. He founded the National Security Archive and was a senior investigator for the Senate Watergate Committee. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, and we begin with Scott Armstrong. Scott, can you talk about this very rare move in the Senate to close out the public, one party, the Democrats, surprising the other, demanding a closed session?
Well, it really was quite dramatic for what we've come to expect from the Senate Democrats, or for that matter, from any Democrats. After having voted for the war in March of 2003, they began to ask questions about the quality of intelligence and basically were held off. They got this study done, but the study didn't really get into what the administration had done with the intelligence, just the flaws within the intelligence. The Scooter Libby case has given them the opportunity to say, now there's evidence on the record that there were some unusual things going on in the doctoring of intelligence, the piecing together, knitting together of very sparse intelligence. And we want to have the rest of this report, which had been put off because of the 2004 election. They want to get it, and they want to get it soon.
Bob Perry, the media is very much playing this as, you know, a partisan game that's going on right now. And now the Democrats are attacking the Republicans, and then the Republicans are attacking the Democrats. But in fact, how serious is this, and what can come of this? I mean, among the people who've been named to the inquiry, the senator from New York, Hillary Rodham Clinton, who continued to support the war, voted for it, and has not withdrawn that support.
Well, it's important that the American people know what happened. This is a war that has been going on now for several years. 2,000 American soldiers have died. Tens of thousands of Iraqis have died. The American status and standing in the world has been put under question. So knowing how we got there is certainly important, if for no other reason than having the facts presented to the American people. The this notion, which I think we go back to even to the first part of the report, that the information should be withheld from the American people until after the 2004 election, was always quite remarkable. I mean, there aren't many chances when Americans have to really weigh in and tell their government what they want done, but to withhold the second half of the report until after that election in 2004 suggests that the idea is never really to include the American people very meaningfully in the process to begin with. But at least now there will be a chance to see if there can be evidence put forth to show what the administration did with the flawed intelligence they got. Clearly, it was a two-step process. There was flawed intelligence, and then there was exaggeration of the flawed intelligence. But knowing the details of that is important.
We're also joined in the New York studio by Gilbert Achkar. He is a longtime analyst of issues specifically concerning the Middle East, Iraq, from Beirut, but living in Paris now. Your response when you just fly into the country and you see Democrats, many of them who authorized the invasion, saying now, well, maybe there was a problem with pre-war intelligence. You are based in a country now that never believed that pre-war intelligence. France and Germany very much opposed and saying that Saddam Hussein was not an imminent threat.
Yes, in the sense that they never stated that Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction because they had no means to assert such a thing, but they thought, and they were right on that the UN inspection procedure was quite enough to make sure that he hadn't. So they saw in this issue of the weapons of mass destruction just a pretext for a war which they understood the United States wanted to wage for some other type of designs linked with, you know, basically the strategic and economic very high value represented by Iraq and its oil.
Bob Perry, when you look at the way intelligence was used and you link it up with the whole Valerie Plame being exposed a story and the number of soldiers now who have died in Iraq, we've passed the 2,000 mark, interestingly, coming the same week, within the same period as the indictments against Scooter Libby. Can you talk about the connection between these two stories, the soldiers dead, not to mention how many Iraqis have died, and the indictment of Scooter Libby?
Well, clearly the American people are more focused now on what's been happening because the promises of first an easy war and then a war that would be eventually brought to some conclusion have turned out not to be true. Vice President Cheney was talking about the insurgency being in its last throes several months ago. And Americans have now seen one of the highest months of American fatalities in Iraq in October. So there are tremendous reasons to have doubts about what the public has been told. And I think going back to the Valerie Plame case, what you saw was essentially an additional step to that three parts, the bad intelligence, the misrepresentation of what was there. But then there was also the idea of punishing anyone who raised questions about that intelligence, which goes back really to before the war, when you had people like Scott Ritter and even some celebrities like Sean Penn going to Iraq and raising doubts about what the administration really had as evidence. Those people were largely dismissed. The French, of course, were attacked. We had French fries being changed to freedom fries in the United States. We had effectively a war hysteria that went on in late 2002 and early 2003. And now we're beginning to see there are consequences when a country loses control of information, where information has been manipulated and misrepresented. People die, and the country suffers dramatically. And I think we're now seeing several parts of that, including the criminality that is alleged to have occurred in the White House relating to Valerie Plame, as another facet of this larger picture. A picture of manipulated information, control of information, as a way to get the American people to do what the White House wanted done.
Scott Armstrong, you played an instrumental role in stopping the Official Secrets Act, a provision that would have criminalized information disclosures by federal employees or whistleblowers for the first time in history. Thanks in large parts to your efforts, President Clinton vetoed the Official Secrets Act. Can you explain what it is and how that fits into what is happening today?
Well, there's always been an attempt by the intelligence community and by certain people and elected officials, appointed officials in any administration, to try and use intelligence, use information inside the government for their own purposes, to leak it selectively. And what's happened over a period of time is each administration gets frustrated by the fact that they can't control all the leaks. And when they can't, they propose that there be an Official Secrets Act. There are some things that are damaging to the national security that could get leaked out. By and large, they don't appear. By and large, those are taken out. Hopefully the reader or the viewer gets the information they need. But journalists tend to take out the things that could be truly damaging, the little details that would reveal that somebody's been compromised or wiretapped or bugged in some other way. So what we've tried to do is keep the intelligence community in a position where the dissent within the intelligence community can continue to come forward. That's what this is really about. There was a leaking war going on in the spring and summer of 2003, and it continued on as the debate about who put the false information or incorrect information about the African yellow cake, the Niger uranium, into the president's speech and elsewhere in public statements. And this was a battle between the White House and the CIA. I think it's really less about punishing Wilson through his wife Valerie Plame than it was their attempt to demythologize and say he wasn't really there on such an important mission. He's just one of those people from the CIA. The irony in this current report that they're arguing over, that they had the closed session about yesterday, is that the report has been basically watered down first by the Senate majority, who have asked relatively irrelevant questions and really haven't gotten to the heart of the matter. And secondly, when they do get information, which frankly some of the analysts inside the CIA are defending their turf, they're trying to show that they were not mistaken as much as they were misused, that information then is quashed by the senior people in the CIA and in the administration. So you have the irony of the Democrats, who haven't done very much to this point, but finally saying, look, this is it. This is, we've gone too long. This is we don't have the information. We're not asking the right questions. And frankly, we need to get the raw information that the intelligence analysts have. That's what the public really needs to have to make a judgment.
We're talking to Scott Armstrong, Executive Director of the Information Trust, and Bob Perry, who is a veteran investigative journalist. We're also joined in our New York studio by Gilbert Achkar, who often contributes to Le Monde Diplomatique in Paris. When we come back, I want to ask Scott Armstrong, who's founder of the National Security Archive, about the federal SHIELD law that, among many others, Judith Miller of the New York Times has been lobbying for. But Scott Armstrong is again against it. We'll find out why in a minute. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Scott Armstrong, Executive Director of the Information Trust. Bob Perry, investigative reporter, used to be with AP and Newsweek, has written the book Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. And in our New York studio, Gilbert Achecard, who joins us from France, has written the book The Clash of Barbarism, September 11th and the Making of the New World Disorder, among other books, just flew into New York. Scott Armstrong, New York Times reporter Judith Miller defended her decision to go to jail to protect a source, she said. She told a journalism conference in Las Vegas that reporters need a federal shield law so that others won't face the same sanctions. She was jailed for 85 days. Your response?
Well, the problem with the shield law as it's proposed now is it has an exception for national security reporting. So the very area in which you would want people to have their sources protected so that they can have a candid conversation. I mean, you really can't talk with government officials about national security issues without them technically, unless they're totally authorized. If they're really giving you a candid view, it's they're violating the law. So the difficulty of being forced to identify your sources through a grand jury isn't really going to be alleviated by this shield law. They did put in some good language about there needing to be imminent damage to the national security before they can call you, but Prosecutor Fitzgerald has already said, as some other people in the Justice Department, that Judy Miller would have been called before the grand jury under this new law anyway. So the question is, are they going to try and get something? Are they going to toughen up other sanctions in return for a shield law that isn't meaningful to the national security reporting, is only meaningful to gossip about interagency contacts over some domestic issue in which the fact of the matter that somebody's off the record isn't particularly critical. The ones that are most critical will be the ones that will be called, still called before a grand jury.
Bob Perry, your response.
Well, it's a very difficult area because there are times you do have to go off the record with sources to get them to discuss what's really going on. The problem with the Judy Miller case, and frankly, a number of cases you see in Washington, is that these are not examples of whistleblowers divulging information that's really important for the American people to know. Often these are government officials using anonymity and often wanting to be treated anonymously to give more credibility to their attacks on people or attacks on political opponents. And so it's more of a game. When I was at Newsweek, we'd often run into cases where sources would want to be treated this way, not because the information was that sensitive, but because they felt it had more sex appeal if it was being done sort of on an off-the-record sources basis. But that doesn't mean there aren't plenty of cases where you really have a scared person in the bureaucracy who needs to tell or wants to tell the American people something and uses the press to do that. In those cases, reporters really probably do have to be willing to take whatever heat they get. But it's not something that can be easily legislated. It's a gray area, and those are always hard to make law about.
Scott Armstrong, as Executive Director of the Information Trust, you are mediating an off-the-record conversation between people in intelligence and journalists. Can you explain what you're doing?
Well, I wouldn't say mediating as much as facilitating. What we're trying to do is make sure that the public can get its information, continue to get information that comes often from what they call unauthorized disclosures, from leaks of national security information. But at the same time, that we don't blunder into something where, as a result of an indiscreet reference, we end up doing something that really does damage the national security, really does allow a terrorist to do something. It's a delicate area, but it's rich in the sense that there are an awful lot of people in the government that would like you to have more information. And for a variety of reasons, Bob mentioned one of them, it puts a premium to hold things secretly. You can leak them selectively. But for a lot of other reasons, too, they feel unable to have these discussions. And so to some extent, we're trying to create mechanisms and feedback loops that allow there to be a discussion between journalists and the national security community that's more candid.
Scott Armstrong and Bob Perry, I want to switch gears a little bit with Gilbert Achcar. In recent months, you've been engaged in a public online debate with University of Michigan professor Juan Cole about whether the U.S. should immediately withdraw from Iraq. You've argued in favor of immediate withdrawal. Juan Cole has warned this could lead to a civil war. We recently talked to Juan Cole, and I wanted to play an excerpt of what he had to say and then get your response. Juan Cole.
Right. Well, I believe that the issue so far has been put in too simplistic a manner. People are saying, well, troops out now, or U.S. out now, or we have to stay the course. And it seems to me that we have lots of options besides those two things, both of which I think are very dangerous. First of all, we learned from Kosovo and Afghanistan they can accomplish a very great deal by giving close air support to an ally on the ground. So I agree that U.S. troops should come out of Iraq first. I think they should come out of the cities. Ultimately, I'd like to see ground forces withdrawn in the main. The danger in doing that, of course, is, and all my Iraqi friends unanimously insist, that if were U.S. troops to withdraw precipitately, there would be a civil war amongst the Sunni Arabs, the Shiites, and the Kurds. But it seems to me that could be prevented by giving close air support to the new Iraqi army and to other allied forces on the ground. And I was in Lebanon during the civil war. I've seen what a civil war really is. What's going on in Iraq right now is not really a civil war. It's a kind of low-intensity conflict. But in a civil war, you have militias mounting set-piece battles, 2,000 guys on each side, firing mortars and shooting at one another. And the U.S. could use its air power to prevent that kind of large-scale civil war in the aftermath of a U.S. withdrawal.
That's University of Michigan professor Juan Cole, Gilbert Achcar, author of Clash of Barbarisms. Your response?
Well, I think there's a contradiction in what Juan has just been saying, because if the purpose is to avoid a civil war, I mean, what he's proposing is basically that U.S. interfere in what would be then very clearly a civil war, because he gives examples of Kosovo and Afghanistan. Well, if that means that the U.S. should be giving military support to one faction of the Iraqi people against another faction of the Iraqi people, what's the name of that, if not a civil war? And I would say a much more dangerous situation than the one we're in right now, where the United States is waging a war against, let's say, a segment of the Iraqi population, but not with the direct participation of the other segment. So I think there's some contradiction here. And besides, the idea of, you know, removing the ground troops and leaving air bases is basically, promoting an idea which resembles the Anglo-Iraqi Treaty of 1930, which was a curse on the new Iraqi state and which led to the fact that the Iraqi monarchy was very much hated by the whole population as some kind of, agency of British imperialism. And if that is what any, government in Iraq intends to make, that would be a disaster for this government and for the future of Iraq. So I think, the whole evolution of the situation in the country, the fact that, we in the anti-war movement, we're saying if the United States invade that country, you will have chaos. Okay, and chaos is there now. And now you have people saying, well, the same people who used to say, I'm not saying that's Juan's case, but most of the people who used to say that would be a cakewalk and everything will be fine, now are saying, oh, but if we go, that will be chaos. Well, chaos is there, and it is a product of the U.S. invasion and occupation. And as General Casey himself said, the very presence of U.S. troops as occupation troops fuels the insurgency. I mean, one cannot say it in better words. And the conclusion of that is that the U.S. troops should get out of this country as soon as possible if we want to have any hope of some kind of reconciliation and rebuilding of national unity in Iraq.
U.S. forces should pull out today?
Well, you know, even if George W. Bush took that decision, they wouldn't be able to do it in 48 hours. They would have to, discuss some kind of short-term timetable with the Iraqi authorities. But the issue is to decide right now to pull out the troops, yes.
What about the situation beyond Iraq, in Iran, in Syria? The U.S. is... very fierce. Condoleezza Rice speaking recently in Congress, talking about, well, already there are cross-border attacks and cross-border bombings the U.S. military is engaged in. What about Syria?
Well, Syria is in a, let's say, quite a difficult position because, the Syrian regime is trying its best to, abide by everything the United States is asking of the regime in terms of Iraqi situation, control of the borders, and all that. And the more they concede, the more they are being asked. And that's the situation in which they are. But as a whole, I think Lebanon specifically is being used as a kind of pressure issue on Syria, on the Syrian regime, and there's some kind of bargaining, some kind of deal going on between Washington on the one hand and Damascus on the other.
Bob Perry, you also have been looking at Syria and the U.S. government.
Well, I think the main point about the report that came out recently on Prime Minister Hariri's assassination in Lebanon is that the American press corps and the international press corps should look at all the information that is being put on the table very skeptically, wherever it comes from, whether it comes from a UN investigator or from the United States or wherever. And I think one of the lessons we should have learned and taken to heart from what the problem in Iraq, which now seems so intractable, is that you should definitely get the facts right and be very skeptical going in, because it's very difficult to get out sometimes. So in the case of the report that came out recently, I did a piece for consortiumnews.com which said that it was a preliminary report. While it did point fingers at the Syrian government and officials in the Lebanon government as well, there were holes in the report. It was not a complete report. And it seems to me that when we approach this, both as journalists and as citizens, we have to make sure that this evidence is good, that it's not something that is going to be exaggerated like we saw in 2002 and 2003 about Iraq. So I think the main point I would put across is that it really is time for the journalists to do their jobs and to be skeptical and look at everything over and over and over again until they can make real sense out of it and not just accept what anyone tells them.
Last comment, Gilbert, on that issue.
Well, I agree entirely with what has been said. I mean, we have to be very much skeptical about all kind of, investigations coming from bodies which we know are under U.S. control, actually. And that's also the case of the U.N. It's not to say that everything in the report is wrong or false, but people have been struck by first of all this the way this report has been published. Even you have had the two versions and all that, and people feel there are some tricks behind that, and also the fact that there are a lot of allegations without concrete proofs, and that's rather strange for that kind of judicial procedure.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Bob Perry with Consortium News, investigative reporter Scott Armstrong of the Information Trust, and Gilbert Achkar, who is here in this country, a columnist and well-known anti-war analyst. He has just flown into the United States, and he'll be speaking tonight in Montclair, New Jersey, tomorrow at the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Community Center in Manhattan, and in New Britain, Connecticut on Friday. And tonight I'll be at SUNY Cortland, tomorrow SUNY Stony Brook, and in San Francisco and New Hampshire this weekend. Check the website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire from Doka Deuce, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.